Congratulations, boy.
I'm going to put my balls in your hands. And, you know, I trust you to hold my, to cut my balls. I'm not being turned on by this at all. That erection, that's not.
that's the wind.
It's not because it's turning me on. I'm always like that. Stiffy McGee, they call me. That's my nickname because I'm just Boner Jones. Now it's just.
Yours doesn't do that. Mine's always like this.
Welcome back to episode 56 of The Life of Augustus Caesar.
And just to let everyone know, we are going to set our standards so much higher for this episode than last time. we want to semi-apologize. Sorry, not sorry. But we're going to do better this time. We're going to do better. No, we're not.
Probably not.
Probably not.
So we left where we left off last time. It's 21 BCE. Augustus is in Sicily doing something to do with the grain. He's also building stuff. He's giving them back some of the cities, their Latin rights. He's making peace with the Sicilians who had been on the wrong side of his war with Mark Antony and with Sexy P before that. Now, as we said last time, it's kind of part of Greater Greece, Sicily, at this stage. And he's been to Greece before, of course, before Big Julie's assassination during the Philippi campaign, during the Battle of Actium. He's been to Greece at all of those periods. And most of Greece had remained loyal to Rome. They'd been caught up in the various Roman civil wars. Not their fault. You know, they had to pick a side.
Yeah.
Quite often they picked the wrong side. Not good at picking sides. Well,
they were 0 for 3.
Going all the way back to King Philip of Macedon and his kid, Al, Big Al of Macedon, particularly the Athenians.
Yeah.
Not really good at picking sides. And even after that, you know, when they've got to pick between Polyperchon and Cassander again and Olympias, they're always picking wrong sides.
Damn. Well, the good news for them is that even though they've screwed up every single time there was a split in Rome, those times are behind them now. Caesar Augustus is there. Everyone knows who he is. Obviously, they knew of a Caesar, the Caesar before they knew of Augustus. But, and like you said on the other episode, when we talk about the elites in Rome trying to be careful not to use the word king or ruler or emperor or whatever, these people don't give a shit because they're used to being ruled outright by kings, by emperors, by pharaohs, whatever. So they don't give a shit about all the niceties. They just know that he is now the king. They have no problem with that. He is just the latest of a long line of rulers who have come over and dominated them. They're just trying to get on with their lives as best they can. So he's going to come over, check some things out. But again, they have, you know, they have picked the wrong side. And so now they have to be very careful about how do they show their loyalty to this guy who is now walking amongst these very cities. So these guys got to be careful. They're a little nervous.
Yeah, people may think, well, what about Athens? Athens is the birthplace of democracy. But of course, as anyone who's listened to our Alexander show knows, Athens hasn't had democracy. But by the time Augustus arrives there in sort of 21, or when he's toying around with Greece anyway, at this stage, Athens hasn't had a democracy since the mid-4th century.
Right.
BCE. So it's been well over 300 years since they really had any form of democracy.
But they're still hanging on that because that's their claim to fame. You know, that's how they bring the tourists in to buy pots and stuff like that. So they're going to hang on to it. Yeah, but it's no longer a reality for these people.
Yeah. I mean, they did have during that period the semblance of democracy. They were allowed to have elections.
Yeah.
But they were basically like Rome's elections at this point. You know, there was a king, a Macedonian of one form or another for centuries and until the Romans then took control of the whole area and defeated the Seleucids and people like that, the Ptolemies, when they took over. Then they had Rome. They were sort of client states of Rome where they sort of had forms of self-rule, but it's really self-rule within the limits that Rome allows you to have self-rule. As I've explained many times, I'm sure, on this show and the Cold War show and the now the Bullshit Filter show, very similar to how the world is still run today by the major powers. And in the 20th century, countries can have independence and run their own elections and do whatever they want as long as they don't upset whichever superpower whose sphere of influence they come under.
Yeah.
If you're a dictator in the Middle East, you can do whatever the fuck you want in terms of oppressing your people and starting wars with the people around you, and the US won't bat an eyelid unless, you know, you get out of line and do something they don't want you to do, and then you find yourself on the wrong end of a rope.
Or there's oil under your ground. But anyway, So for these people, I mean, they've seen coins, they've seen images, they've seen the name Caesar, they've seen the name Augustus. To them, it's no big deal. Hey, tell us what you want us to do. We'll do it. We're just like trying to get on with our lives. So for them, they're, you know, when he comes, it's an opportunity for them to kiss the royal ass, not the royal ring, and hopefully get something out of it, because they're just trying to better their position just like everyone else is.
Now, Ray, when you take the name Augustus and render it in Greek, do you know what it is?
Is that Sebastos?
Sebastos.
Sebastos, yeah. The August now, one.
Yeah, the Reverend or the August one. Now, in 64 BCE, after the Third Mithridatic War, our old buddy P to the G was reorganizing Asia Minor, and he founded a city in central Turkey called Megalopolis, the great city, not the Megalopolis that we're familiar with from our Alexander show. It's a different Megalopolis, but this Megalopolis. And in the first century BCE, the city changed its name to Sebaste, which is the feminine form of the Greek name Sebastos, which corresponded to Augustus. Now the name, Sebastian comes from Sebaste, the name of the city. It means if you were the person from Sebaste, you were Sebastian.
Gotcha.
And so anyone you know today called Sebastian actually is named after Augustus, because Sebastian comes from that. Saint Sebastian, the Christian martyr who got shot with a bunch of arrows and somehow miraculously survived, apparently.
Because of God.
But,
so Sebastian because Bach. I just saw him. I saw him in a play, dude. Jesus Christ Superstar.
Really?
Yeah. Oh fuck! What? It's not Poison. What
wasn't
band?
Poison? I don't know. I can't remember, man.
Shit! I'm looking right at Motley Crue.
No, it wasn't Motley Crue. Although I think he was rumored as a fill-in he was going to fill in lead singer for them for a while. Skid Row.
Skid Row.
Skid Row.
I got their poster right.
Eighties hair metal band for the kids that were around in the '80s, like us. Sebastian Bach, one of those androgynous guys who, you know.
Did you like Def Leppard?
Almost like a woman.
Did you like Def Leppard? Yeah, love Def Leppard. They're my favorite. Out of that genre, Def Leppard, fucking awesome. Anyway, everybody go check it out. If you're under 18, go check it out.
Not looking too good these days, Sebastian Bach. Looking at the photos I've got. He looked like a supermodel chick in the 80s, man.
Right.
Like, you know,
in a good way.
Now, he's didn't.
He looked like a supermodel who did a whole bunch of coke and didn't eat. But in a good, sexy kind of 80s way. And now I think it's caught up to him.
He did have a great voice, though. Really
yeah.
Good voice.
Yeah.
Anyway, Sebastian.
My name's Sebastian.
So, shout out to our listener, Sebastian Bartram and Sebastiana Savoia.
Ah.
You're named after Augustus, so there you go. Don't know if you knew that, but now you know that.
You do.
Anyway, so the Greeks were issuing coins with Augustus's head or the symbols of Israel. They were sucking up majorly hard right. to him at this period. 50 years later, when Jesus supposedly asked whether the Jews should pay taxes to Rome, and according to the New Testament, he took out a silver coin and said, "Whose image is on it?" And this is where he said, "Render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's."
Mm-hmm.
Even though Tiberius would have been the emperor, assuming any of that actually happened,
right.
Probably the coin he used would have been one bearing Augustus's image.
Yeah.
Interestingly, there are fringe theories about Christianity that say that whole story
right.
Is sort of central to the idea that Christianity was created by the Romans to try and convince the Jews to pay their taxes and to pacify the Jews.
Wow. Wow.
Because Jesus said, pay your taxes. And so I think it's a bit of a stretch, but that's one theory that you will find. When you get into Christianity, history, conspiracy theories, that's one of them.
Nice.
So his image was on coins, on statues, as we've talked about before. Far, far more people would have seen him on statues and on coins than would actually have seen him in real life.
Or anybody else, for that matter. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't like to get out and walk the streets so much, but, you know, he traveled around, as we said, and everyone started to refer to the year as the year of Caesar.
Yeah.
There's a papyrus written in 26 BCE, so sort of 5 years earlier, in Egypt, talking about the lease of a cow. And it is dated as the fifth year of the domination of Caesar, son of the deified.
Hell yeah. And that's on a legal document. That's on a business transaction document. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, in Egypt. And the date of his reign would have been the date of the death of Cleopatra when he became the new ruler of Egypt.
Right.
And as we've said before, for people like the Egyptians, Augustus was just the latest in a long line of foreign rulers, including the Greeks and the Persians.
Yeah.
So same old, same shit, different day for the Egyptians.
Yeah, but at the same time, he was the Sebastian Bach of his day because he was a rock star. His name was everywhere. His image was everywhere. You know, forget Jesus, forget Julius Caesar, the Caesar. I mean, this guy's name is everywhere. And we're going to probably get into this later, and I'm not going to say too much, but the people are going to start, you know, offering up things to him. They're going to start worshiping him to a degree, which is going to make him extremely uncomfortable and something he's not going to like. But that's part and parcel of what it means to be the emperor, to be the ruler, to be the king almost, and to be the adopted son of someone who's been deified. So there's going to be a lot of baggage with this that's not going to make him feel comfortable, but it's politically expedient, so you go along with it.
I don't know that he would have found it that uncomfortable.
Really? I mean, I don't know. I don't have anything. I'm just imagining he's a sensible Roman. He believes in his gods. He doesn't think, I mean, I'm thinking he doesn't think he's something divine because I think he knows it's all bullshit, but that's just my guess. And now these people started to make offerings to him, my child's sick or the harvest or whatever. I just think he would have saw it for the BS that it was.
Maybe. He doesn't seem to go all Alexander on it and start saying, yeah, you know what? Maybe I am a fucking god. But I just think he does see himself as what he is. He is a king.
Yep.
He knows he's a king. He knows he is the monarch of Rome. I mean, he's trying to paint it as something slightly different. But, yeah, of course he knows what he is.
Right.
And they're treating him like that. Maybe they do start to treat him as a bit of a deified king. But I don't know. I think he's probably aware of that's, you know, you just let the simple people go along with that.
Right. Makes them happy. Keeps them quiet.
Yeah, look, I think rulers throughout time, including today, it's a bit like you know, your President Trump, your President Trump going to church and right. pretending that he's and having like prayer meetings and that kind of shit. Like, really? Does yeah. anyone really think no. Trump is a believer in any god but himself?
No. And it's a test of his endurance to go to church.
it's what you do to just keep the dumb people happy. You know, he knows that there's a lot of people out there in his voting base mm-hmm. that are believers, that are a little bit simple-minded, and he's going, look, you've got to play the game. Mate, let them think that I believe and that I give a shit. Just go along with it, and it'll keep them happy, and I'll get what I want. I think it's the same with rulers throughout history, including Augustus. He's like, look, if they want to believe that I'm a god and they want to come and bow down and pray to me, okay, whatever. Yeah. Like, you know.
Well, now I feel sorry for Trump because every Sunday for the next 4 years, he's got to go do something that he doesn't want to do. And this man who's around 70 years old is used to not doing anything he doesn't want to do. So, you know, you got to feel sorry for him a little bit. Not really.
He'll just be tweeting in church, dude.
What?
He'll just be tweeting when he's in church. You know, he'll probably really build his own.
Feeling God, build it, very good, cool.
He'll build his own little like viewing station in whichever church in Washington he's going to, which mm-hmm. will just be a toilet that he can sit in. So, well, technically I was at church, and then he'll just tweet from it, you know. That's just, and then he only has to worry about it until he removes elections altogether in the US.
Right.
And appoints himself, you know, whatever, the Führer. God. And he won't have to worry about keeping up the facade. Anyway, back to Egypt and the provinces.
Yeah.
So, as I said, I think earlier on, I mean, the Athenians hadn't really had any form of democracy since Philip had conquered them 300 years earlier. But the good thing, so it's they don't care. The people in the provinces probably don't give a shit. It's only the elite in Rome that care because it's infringing on their ability to right. get wealth and power for themselves. It's rest of the people, pride. It's same old, but with the added benefit of Pax Romana and the added benefit of him spending big in all of these places that he goes to, building temples, building monuments, building amphitheaters, investing in the region. So it's pretty much all good for the people out in the provinces.
Yeah.
And it's also good for him. While he's away from Rome, he doesn't need to pretend that he isn't a monarch.
Right.
He can, you know, do what I do when Chrissy's not home.
Right.
And I can just walk around in my underwear and let it all hang out.
I preach, my dear friends, you're about to receive on John Barleycorn, nicotine, and the temptations of Eve. No barking by the sewer sign, hot dog, my razor broke, water dripping up the spout, but I don't care, let it all hang out. Hanging from a pine tree by my knees, sunshine through the shade. Nobody knows what it's all about. It's too much, man, let it all hang out.
Yeah, the hombres, man, let it all hang out. Oh, such a good feeling when you can just let it all hang out.
Yes. Oh, right now. What?
So, back to the people. So, they knew how to suck up to a king. They'd been doing it forever, the people and the provinces. How do you suck up to a king? Well, you build temples to him.
Right.
You build statues of him. You show him that you respect him and hope in turn that he'll be nice to you and show you favor.
Yeah. I like the one where they would build something and they would either send an ambassador or a letter. By the way, we just want to let you know that we think so much of you. We built this and let me describe it to you or whatever. By the way, why I've got your ear, I have a request to make or whatever. So again, even for them, they're playing the game, you know, like when we were talking about during the Alexander show, some of the people were sucking up to Alexander. I mean, yeah, so they're building these things. They're in case it comes through town, they can see, yes, we built this thing and we inscribed your name on it, you and a gripper or whatever, you know. But if I do get a chance to talk to you, you know, these taxes are killing us, dude. Could we talk about a slight reduction? But again, it was just both sides. He was pretending to, you know, to care about them or whatever. He's bringing money. He's spending a ton of money. They pretend to love him. And by the way, when they get a chance, they ask for a favor. Everybody's playing the game.
Yeah. I think that's a brilliant tactic.
Yeah.
To get his attention. They're building stuff to compete for his attention because he's got a big empire and everyone's trying to get an audience.
Yeah, you got to bring everyone's the Flash. Like, you got to bring the Flash to get his attention.
Yeah, can I just get 5 minutes, Augustus? Yeah. And he's like, well, what have you done for me lately? Well, we built a statue. Oh, really? Okay. Now, Athens played this game quite a bit earlier. In 27 BCE, a city magistrate in Athens had dedicated a new monopterus, which was a circular colonnade supporting a roof but without any walls.
Get out of here.
No, I will not.
Was that magic?
No, you have a bunch of columns in a circle with a roof, supporting a roof, but no walls.
Right, gotcha. Okay.
The roof's resting on the columns. There's actually one of those in Chrissy's hometown, Cedar City, Utah, at the University of Southern Utah, I think. Wow. There they have one of those, and it has a bunch of philosophers in it, which is funny in Utah. but they've got Aristotle. I had my photo taken, I think, the last time I was there, me hanging out with Aristotle. People went, Aristotle and Plato and Socrates and whatever they have. So anyway, back to this one that they built in Athens. The inscription said it was erected by the people to the goddess Roma and Caesar Augustus, because Augustus's rule was, at this point, they were allowed to dedicate cult offerings to him as long as they combined the deity of Rome, Roma, the goddess, alongside him. So not just him alone, they also had to have the goddess of Roma. And altars like this popped up all around the provinces at the time. They were popping up all through Asia Minor, places like Miletus and Ephesus. So that was one reason why people built stuff to get on his radar, as you said earlier.
Now, did you read the – because I was looking through there, you know, because like you said, Athens has been choosing the wrong side since who knows, who can remember. And so I'd read somewhere, excuse me, that he took away and I didn't find the timeline for this. So I wonder if when he comes through, is he maybe restoring some rights to people, maybe like he did in Sicily. But supposedly he took away Erigena and Etruria, because they had that under their possession. But because they took the side of Mark Antony, he took that away from them and forbade them to use it any ever again to make money. So I think, just like everyone else, each city-state has its outlying territory that they either squeeze for taxes or they grow crops or the resources. And so he's coming through there. Maybe he's taking something away to punish them. Maybe he's returning territory or rights to them because they've already been punished. But again, everybody's got to be very careful and to kiss this guy's butt as much as you can to hopefully get something out of it for yourself, for your family, but also for your city-state, because that's still very important in Greece.
Yeah. And it was easier for the bigger, wealthier cities in the provinces to do this kind of thing, building temples, building statues. Yeah. The poorer cities couldn't do that, so they had to basically just get down on their knees and beg. In 29 BCE, so quite a bit earlier than 21, Strabo, the Greek geographer, was on a ship that was anchored off a small fishing village on the Greek island of Gyaros. By the way, I posted up on our Facebook page yesterday a map of the world according to Strabo. And also an earlier one from Eratosthenes. They're similar in terms of their scope. But it's just interesting to look at the map of the world as it was known in the first century and I think the third century with Eratosthenes. Just to see, it looks kind of small, right? I look at that and I go, I could conquer that. It's not that big, you know? Yeah, it's doable. That's doable.
You can ride a bicycle across that.
Yeah. Anyway, so he was on this ship, and one of the fishermen came on board the ship and said he was the ambassador for his village. Again, it's a small fishing village.
Right.
They were sending him to see Augustus to beg for a reduction in the tribute they had to pay.
Mm.
And Strabo mentions it because it was an example of how poor this village was. They wanted their tribute reduced from 150 drachmas
right.
down to 100, which was less than the value of a single cow.
Damn. They're poor. Wow. Wow.
Now, yeah.
What is this guy's chances of meeting Augustus? I mean, if you think about it, he and Agrippa must have had thousands of meetings like this every year. I would really love to know if he ever made it and was able to stand before the Great One and put his plea to him.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't know. We don't. The Strabo doesn't mention. They say that they took him to Corinth, where Augustus was pausing on his way back to Rome at the time. We there's no record of what happened to this guy. But you have to think, as you say, that Augustus and Agrippa are just getting lines up around the block every day of people from big cities, from little cities, little villages, important people, unimportant people, just trying to put their petition. And you kind of see this portrayed on the Game of Thrones and shows like that, TV and movies, where you have the ruler and you just have this line. The ruler's just bored off their ass.
Right.
Because there's just line after line after line of people asking for justice, asking for reductions in tributes, asking for rulings on land disputes or this, that, or the other. It's got to get really, really tedious and boring after a while. Do you just say no to everybody? How do you know who to say yes and who to say no to?
Yeah.
How many fact-finding missions can you create? How many, in this case, when they're asking for a reduction of your tribute, you go, well, if I reduce your tribute,
yeah,
everyone's going to ask for me to reduce their tributes. Right. I mean, how do I give you special dispensation here? I mean, it must have been, a boring, thankless, tough job to be in this position.
Yeah. And that's the whole point of having an empire, is to make a ton of cash while you can. So, you know, you got to, and if anything, this shows that Augustus needed Agrippa, someone to take some of the work from him, because one man could not possibly do all of these things.
I'd be appointing lots of people. I'm not doing that anymore. Yeah. You guys see my secretary.
I know. I'd set up a dartboard and you hit it over here. The answer to your question is yes. You hit it over here. The answer is no. Fucking just throw it and then move on. Just move on. I mean, that's just, but you've got to think. You've got to look at the big picture. You say yes to this guy. You say no to this guy. Maybe they're neighbors. Maybe they talk. Maybe you're creating some animosity for your people. So, yeah, you just wonder, how do they possibly decide what's best for themselves, what's best for Rome, and not piss everybody off? Again, it's just a burden I would not want. What's that sword hanging over the sword of Damocles, you know, hanging over your head? I would not want that kind of power or responsibility.
It's kind of like the way you don't reply to anyone's emails, because you are so famous and well-loved.
Well,
if you answer one person's email, you have to answer everybody's email. And otherwise, you get accused of showing favoritism. People will say snarky things about you, people outside of your wife and D'Angelo. So, you know, you implemented a policy, quite sensible, I think, many years ago. You just don't reply to anyone's emails, including mine half the time.
I mean, you say that and you're giving me attitude, but it really, it's a good policy. I don't have time, okay? If you can't, I don't know, get in my face, build a monument to me, somehow get my attention, I can't work you in. I cannot work you in. It's nothing personal. It is never personal when I ignore you or anybody else for that matter.
Yeah. That's why I had to build a voodoo doll of you, and now I just stick needles in it when I want your attention.
How accurate is that? How anatomically accurate is that?
Well, it's a it's a scale model. It sits on my desk. It's 1-to-1 scale. Life size.
What's it wearing, if anything?
No, nothing.
Okay.
It's letting it all hang out. By the way, that island of Gyaros, the fishing village, today it's uninhabited.
Oh, we should take it over. Invasion.
Well, you might be fighting the mice. In the first century CE, Pliny the Elder wrote that the inhabitants of Gyaros were run off of the island by a plague of mice.
Attack, get them!
It also served as a place of exile during the early Roman Empire. In the early 2nd century CE, the Roman historian Tacitus wrote that when Silanus, the proconsul of Asia, was accused of extortion and treason, it was proposed in the Senate that he be exiled to Gyaros. Mm. But the emperor Tiberius sent him to a nearby island, Kithnos, instead, because he said Gyaros was harsh and devoid of human culture.
Oh, that's nice.
Bit like where you are in Virginia. I think that's why you were exiled there in the first place. There was another instance where another guy was supposed to be exiled to Gyaros, and Tiberius once more said, come on, that's a bit harsh.
Yeah.
He said the island was deficient in water, and those who were granted their lives ought to be granted the means to live.
Oh, and as we all know, Tiberius was just a gentle touch, gentle soul, just one big heart. Just one big.
He was,
yeah,
lovely, yeah. Lovely fellow. He was lovely fellow. We might get so far as to talk about him one day. We'll see how it goes.
We'll see.
Yeah. There is a red brick prison. So still talking about Gyaros on the island, which was used during the Greek Civil War to hold prisoners. 10,000 men, members of the Greek resistance.
Damn.
Were held there. Jehovah's Witnesses were also sentenced there because they were conscientious objectors during the Greek Civil War. It was again used as a prison during the years 57 to 64 because of the problems in Greece. And then I think later there was the Greek military junta of 67 to 74. So it gets used as a prison, a really, really fucking harsh.
Damn.
What's that prison off the coast of San Francisco on the island?
Oh, is that Alcatraz?
Alcatraz? Yeah, it's like Alcatraz, or
for mice.
Like Saint Helena. No, it's further away than Alcatraz, not quite as far as Saint Helena,
right?
Where the Greeks like to send people. By the way, Strabo, before we move on, came from Pontus, and his mother's family were very closely connected with Mithridates the Great.
Oh.
Just going to throw that out there. I read a bit about Strabo over during the week.
That's cool. No, I just wondered if the mice ever set up their own government on that island. I mean, they deserve freedom too.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
democracy of the mice. I wonder if that's where the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin comes from. I wonder if it was the Pied Piper of Gyaros originally that led the children off the cliff.
And they just changed some names. So the one thing I find interesting is that as much as we've talked about Athens has been making wrong decisions over the years or whatever, and that this place, all these different city-states have got to suck up and build monuments because now there's a new king in town. Literally, there's a new king in town. And they need him to believe that they love and respect and revere him. The Greeks have got one massive ace up their sleeve that no one else has got. And that is that the Romans revere the history, the culture of Greece. And so that is something that they can tap into to really try to impress these people, to try to use that and maybe sell some off some of their heritage or whatever. But they've got this one big advantage that the Romans really admire this place, their past and everything they've done, all the amazing people that have come before them. And so they're going to use that to their best of their ability. And it is a good propaganda point for them to use.
Mm.
By the way, I'm not sure if you picked this up in your research, but Augustus actually wrote a song that he had played whenever he visited one of these new cities in the provinces.
No.
Johnny come lately.
There's a new king in town.
Everybody loves you.
You better love me.
So don't fuck around. You look in her
eyes. Oh my God, we are sinking our menstrual cycles. This is getting crazy.
Now, as I said before, the bigger communities had a better chance of getting his attention.
Yeah.
But that wasn't always a good thing. Athens, again, as an example, had supported Brutus, Cassius, Antony, Cleopatra, always on the wrong side of history, as I said. And Augustus made them pay for it afterwards. But they're going to build monuments to him too. And they'd started, as I said, I think back in 2027, trying to get on his good side. Now, they had also been on the wrong side of history. They sided back with their old mate, the poison king, Mithridates of Pontus, against Rome.
Oh.
Sulla, as a result, had sacked the city. But even Sulla back then went easy on them because, as you said, of their history of being the center of Greek civilization. He, right. at the time, said he would spare the living for the sake of the dead.
Oh, those great Greeks who had come before them. So, yeah, the Romans have a little soft touch for the Greeks, and it's totally understandable.
And they had survived Athens, but they had become little more after that point than just a museum to the past. Yeah. Roman aristocrats would still visit and build statues or monuments to famous dead Athenians, poets and philosophers and these sorts of things. But
and take selfies.
Yeah, but and Augustus and his inner circle did the same, but obviously on a far larger scale. Agrippa built a new Odeon in Athens. Odeon is a singing place. That's what it translates into. It's a roofed theater. He built it in the middle of the old marketplace, the Agora, and it was huge, lavish, as you'd expect. A large roof unsupported by pillars. This one was just pure magic.
Right.
Roman technology and Roman concrete that allowed them to do this. And Augustus and Agrippa's names and images and symbols were carved on the building. It was used for traditional Greek drama and Greek music, Greek singing, but the Greeks, the Athenians, are celebrating their traditional drama and music in this huge fuck you of a building that has Augustus and Agrippa's likenesses and image and symbols all over it. So a big fuck you to the birthplace of democracy, really.
Yeah, I'd read that it was a two-story auditorium, could seat 1,000 people. It had a raised stage, a marble paved orchestra. So, so it was just massive, over-the-top thing. So here are the Greek singers singing, celebrating, whatever they're doing, perpetuating Greek culture in a Roman construction. So, yeah, just a big Roman middle finger to all the Greeks who made the wrong decision like 27 times in a row.
Yeah, back then, you know, the bookies used to look at how Athens was going to go on a war, and then they just put the odds again
we'll
on
take the opposite.
Yeah. But again, I think the people of Athens really, like the people in Rome, the regular people, the civvies, the civilians, the the prolies, the what do we call the Romans? The I've got a mental blank. I haven't had enough coffee.
The plebs, the plebeians.
Thank you.
Uh huh.
They don't give a fuck who's in control, who the power is, who's the boss. They're just happy to not be at war, to have pretty things to look at, and to be able to bang the sheep. Sex with sheep. That's all they care about.
Did you say sexy sheep or sex with sheep?
Both. With sexy sheep. Just to live, like, that's all normal people want.
Right.
Most of you. Look, I know we have a few people who listen to this show that are, you know, extremely wealthy.
people. Mm-hmm. But and I'm sure even you just want to live your life, you know, be married if you're married, be not married if you're not married, but, you know, live your life, you know, have happiness and fulfillment, enjoy your friends and your family, live the good life. But those of us that don't have wealth, you know, are just scraping by, do we really care who the government of the day is if it doesn't affect us? I mean, most people, do you think in America or Australia or England or Canada or wherever, China, Russia, do they really care who's in power today? Or do they just care about, look, I want a roof over my head, food on the table, mm-hmm. I want some entertainment options, I want to be able to work, pursue my hobbies, I want to be able to have sex on a regular basis if I can get it, if my wife would, you know, stop looking at D'Angelo.
Get that black guy out of here.
I want my children to be – now, of course, you and I are doing the bullshit show, the bullshit field where we're talking about Syria, and, I mean, the people in Syria today,
right?
500,000 people dead, 12 million people displaced. They don't have those simple luxuries.
Right.
I've been listening over the last few weeks to interviews with people living in places like Aleppo. You know, they're just struggling to get food every day. And when they do, it's you know, really basic, a few beans and flour.
And you've probably seen the footage of someone sending a drone over Aleppo.
Yeah.
I mean, just completely devastated. Everything is rubble. It's just insane. So here we are bitching about our lives. Oh, I have to work. I have to go in Monday. These people don't even have the basics. So, yeah, everybody just wants to be left alone to live their lives. And it doesn't matter who's the person on top. It doesn't change my life all that much.
And, you know, the people of Athens have been involved in countless fucking wars going mm-hmm. back centuries and centuries and centuries. On our Alexander show, we've talked about how they had brief moments, a decade here or a decade there of peace under Philip, under Alexander, later on under anti-gonad. more often than not, I think it was under Cassander, actually. They got a decade of peace under Cassie. But more often than not, over the centuries, they've been involved in a war against the other Greek city-states, against the Persians, against the Romans, against the Macedonians, you know, just this fucking Macedonian general versus that Macedonian general. So to have peace for the average citizen, just to have peace, is a blessing. And Augustus has given them that.
Yeah, so they've got peace. They're going to build some things to kiss his ass. But now it's time for some entertainment. And like you were saying before, Augustus is coming through with his big old credit card, a black credit card, big black credit card, unlimited. He can build things. So he's going to start building things. The rich people in the community are going to start building things as well. They're going to take the hint. And so they might get positions of power, local administration. But it's understood because Augustus is making it quite clear. Look, you can be in charge, but I expect you to do some things to help the people of your city, whether it's entertainment or whatever, or infrastructure, that kind of stuff. So it's a two-way street. There's a new way to do things and with Rome in charge. You can be in charge and you can be part of the administration, but you better be doing something for the commoners, because that's what I'm doing in Rome and I expect you to copy me.
His big black swinging credit card that we just call the D'Angelo card from now on. Now, the Romans actually respected the idea of the city-state because it had come from Greece and they loved, their Greek history.
Mm-hmm.
Augustus actually starts allowing the locals to have more power than they had previously in terms of collecting taxes and levies. Now, under the Republic, the job of collecting taxes from the provinces, the client states, places like that, actually was a job that was given to Roman contractors, the publicani, the publicans.
Yeah.
Now, the publicani did a number of different things. They were contractors who won the right to oversee public building contracts, tax collection, all sorts of things, supplying the Roman army mm-hmm. with food and goods.
So a publicani was somebody who undertook public projects as a contractor. And every few years, the contract for collecting taxes in the various regions went up for auction. And the way that this was worked out, I found, was fascinating. Right. The value of the contract was the estimated amount of tax to be collected over the period of the contract. Mm-hmm. And the winning contractor would have to pay Rome that full amount up front.
Ah. So you get a bunch of rich friends, a hedge fund, you get a bunch of money, you win the contract, you pay that, and now you got to go get your money back.
Yes. So the upside was, if you could collect more than you had paid for the contract, that was pure profit. If you couldn't collect, that was the risk. You lost money. But you had to pay it up front. So Rome got the money. Now, Rome considered it a loan and paid interest on it. So that was fair and reasonable. Right. So I guess you could still profit, depending on what rates you borrowed the money from in the first place, you might profit from the interest rates. You might be able to triage that a little bit. Triage isn't the word I'm looking for. What's the word I'm looking for?
Offset.
Fuck. Well, yeah, let's just go with that. Yeah. But it's an interesting business model. Now, by the 18th century, the word publican meant the owner or manager of a tavern, a pub, a public house. And in England, I read, in the late 12th century, there existed a religious sect called the Publicani.
Right.
Amongst their beliefs, Ray, was the view that all procreation was a sin. Now, they were considered heretical and persecuted in the 12th century, and they died out. But you'd have to think,
wouldn't they just die out because they weren't having sex?
Yeah. They think all procreation is a sin. Just let them go. Like, they're not going to last very long.
They'll be gone in a generation. Boom, done. Yeah. Next.
I wouldn't have bothered trying to wipe them out.
Right.
I'd love to know a little bit more about how they came to that conclusion. Yeah, genius. Well, you think regular Christians think that sex out of marriage or sex not for the sake of procreation is bad? We're going to take it up a notch.
It's like, oh, you think, hold my beer.
You think you're righteous? Oh, well, can we step it up a notch? All sex is bad.
Yeah. I can beat that. I got that beat. No, everybody in my sect is going to cut off their penis. That's how much we believe in this.
Oh, you are so righteous. Hey, we're going to go one more. We think being alive is a sin. We're all going to commit suicide. Wait,
we're going to put on the same clothes, take this pill, and lay down and be all done.
Drink the Kool-Aid. Yeah. So Augustus changes this, gets rid of the publicans, says, no, we'll let the locals collect the taxes now. Bad for the publicans in Rome, but good for the local aristocracy out in the regions, because now they're the ones that get to profit. And they probably know who's who in the zoo in their local areas. They're probably able to better estimate who they're going to be able to get tax from, what the taxes should be, you know, how much income these people are earning from their businesses, their farms, their properties, their mines, etc.
Yeah.
But it's another way for Augustus to keep the provincial aristocrats happy with his rule, another way of preventing them from rising up, maybe causing trouble, trying to overthrow Rome, doing a deal with the Parthians, whatever it is. Because if you keep the local aristocrats rich and fat, they're more likely to support your ongoing rule.
So I'm rich. I build a statue or whatever to Augustus. He appoints me as the local administrator for a year or two. I'm the big man. He's not going to come around and check us. He doesn't care. I could pretty much do what I want as long as I pay whatever I got to pay and I don't cause any trouble. I'm pretty much my own little tiny independent sub-king here. Life is not all that bad. And again, Rome doesn't care. They're just, as long as they get paid on time, everybody's happy. So it's good for him and it's good for them. It works for everybody. And everybody's going to be ruled by someone else. So why not go along with someone who's willing to do this with you?
And to bring that into a modern context, I think this is still the way things are done. You know, again, spheres of influence, superpowers overseeing countries. Mm-hmm. You know, you keep your allies in whatever country it is that you want to keep your finger on, whether it's the politicians or the leading business people, the leading religious leaders in these countries, fat and happy. You kick them in on contracts, you pay them big salaries, you support you know, their military rule with weapons and weapons deals, arms deals, with training. You keep them, the people on top, happy, and they will take care of the population for you.
Nice.
It's a much more cost-effective way of imperialism. You don't have to go and invade a country, as we've talked about in the Cold War show. You don't have to send your own armies in.
Yeah. Fuck the hearts and minds. Just get their loyalty, even if it's political and financial. Well,
you just support the elite. If you can support the elite will keep the masses in line.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. They'll invest their time and money and influence, keeping the locals in line. And you've only got to keep a couple hundred people in line. They'll keep the couple hundred thousand in line.
Or a couple of hundred million.
Oh, yeah.
Or tens of millions, whatever. And you just say to them, look, you know, we'll support you. If anyone gets out of line, you can call upon us to come in and smack rattle the sword.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll tell the media that you're the good guys. Okay, so you're the self-styled monarchy of Saudi Arabia. You're one of the few countries who haven't signed the United Nations Human Rights Declaration. You're beheading and crucifying people just for being atheists or for questioning your kingdom or your religion. You know, you're actively involved in destabilizing Syria and Yemen and other countries. But hey, we'll tell everybody that you're the good guys because you're selling us your royal.
Not only that, but you're America's most loyal ally in the region, and we should love you for it.
It doesn't matter what you do, we'll protect you.
Right.
Anyway, okay. Back to Rome. Now, unlike in Rome, where Augustus, as we've seen, had put strict limits on aristocrats throwing festivals and having triumphs, mm-hmm. and he wants to limit the ability for the people back in Rome to show off their wealth and to use it to buy the love and support of the people because that's a threat. Well,
Let me ask you a quick question. Don't interrupt me half sentence, Ray. I'm sorry. We have a bad connection. I apologize.
Okay.
Can I ask my question now?
Yes, you can.
Right. So as far as the limiting the people, was that financial so that they're not spending money? Was that so no one could become a demagogue? Or was he trying to regulate the morals of the upper classes of Rome? Or was it maybe all of it combined together?
Good question. I mean, I think there's probably a little bit of all of that. I think his primary motivation, though, mm-hmm. is to stop the demagogues from rising up because he knows Romans are a sucker for a good demagogue.
Right.
America.
They really were.
Like America, yeah.
I'm sorry. So please continue. I apologize.
That's all right. No, I think he justified it with the other things. Look, let's be a little bit more humble in our, you know, let's not, we're getting gaudy. We're becoming a bunch of dicks. Like, let's tone it down a little bit.
Don't be a dick.
I think he justified it with that, but I suspect his actual motivation was just to make it more difficult for people to build their brand as being, hey, I'm better than Augustus, or I deserve it as much as Augustus. But out in the provinces, he actively encouraged it. Oh, build theaters, build festivals, have festivals, just get it. Yeah, party on, people.
Yeah.
Party on Wayne, party on Garth. Yeah, it's all good. Because, these people weren't going to be threats, and B, it meant that the people were happy with the new regime because there's more festivals, there's music, there's actors, there's athletes, everything's happening. There's jobs for all the athletes and the actors.
Gladiators.
With these new stadiums. Gladiators.
Yeah.
And that was a new thing in the provinces now is the gladiator trials. People had tried to introduce them before, but the locals were disgusted. This is horrible. But now they take to it like teenage Ray took to sex with cousins and sheep, which in Virginia are often the same thing. Augustus also encourages the local aristocracy to compete for magistracies in their cities. Nice. Now
keep them busy too. Yeah.
Yeah, keep them busy and say, look, you know, throw your money at this. It's expensive, like it used to be in Rome.
Right.
Well, probably still is in Rome. To compete for these elections, you've got to buy the love of the people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're spending their money on that, which is keeping them in hoc. It's keeping them, as you say, occupied. It's giving them opportunities to profit in their local area. The other upside for them is if they win the elections, they have an opportunity to win favor with Augustus by saying, well, look, under my rule, we built this statue to you. And maybe if they can get on his good side, they might gain Roman citizenship, get a chance to have a career in his service, maybe get the fuck out of the backwaters, move to the big smoke, the big apple.
Right.
And essentially, they are all competing for his love. And he wrote a song encouraging them to do that.
Thank God.
Waiting for you. Justify my love, my love. Hoping, my love. Praying for you to justify my love.
Sorry, I need to get a tissue after that, man. That's that's her voice and that song.
She was good
pure sex on a stick.
You made a good point, but yeah, because if they can get citizenship and they can get a toehold onto the imperial ladder, the imperial service, I mean, there's no telling how far they could go. Maybe one of them could become consul one day. Maybe one of them could be in his inner circle, or they could help whoever comes next after Augustus. So yeah, if they can get on the inside track, who knows? It's pretty much up to their talents to see how far they can go after that.
So he's got them busy competing, trying to win his love. So the people are happy with their festivals and the peace. The aristocrats are happy competing for his love. He's doing a good job sort of taking care of people's basic needs for peace, love, and harmony. And for the aristocrats to feel like they've got an opportunity, they've got a chance.
Yeah,
to build their family's name and make some coin. Now, the local elites were typically the client rulers of these estates, and under Augustus, they end up controlling more of Asia Minor and Syria than Roman governors had or did. Guys like Herod the Great, who we've talked about in the past briefly, they were given a certain amount of independence, again, as long as they towed the line, a bit like client rulers and dictators today.
Right.
They were allowed to have small armies. Oh, time's up. They were allowed to have small armies, and they even sometimes fought each other, which was risky if they didn't have prior approval from Rome.
Yeah.
Because Augustus could come and strip them of their power at any time, and none of them could really withstand an attack from Augustus if he chose to. But they were allowed to have a certain amount of independence and military power in their region.
Yeah, so as long as they toe the line, they can do what they want. Just don't up. Just, you know, it's almost like if you want to get Augustus' attention, it better be over something good and not bad, because I don't care how long your family's been in charge or the royal line or whatever, he can just snap his fingers and you are suddenly out of power and maybe out of breath, because he pretty much runs everything. So it's all about appeasing this one human being.
Now, these client rulers may not have had to pay a regular tribute to Rome, like our little friend of the fishing village of Gyaros.
Right.
But they did often send gifts like gold crowns, or they provided resources to Roman campaigns, food, soldiers, different forms of support, resources.
So that may have been what they did in lieu of a regular tribute is, okay, well, look, you don't have to pay us cash tribute every year, but, you know, I expect a couple of gold crowns. You know, my gold crown cabinet is running low. Got to keep them gold crowns.
I'm sorry.
No, go.
No, I was just going to say, so no matter what you send or however you send it, when you go to the post office to ship it off, just check gift as far as description. Yeah. And that way you get to keep your pride. I get what I want. Everybody's happy.
And I don't have to pay duties on it when it comes here because, you know, what's the point of getting a gold crown if I have to pay for receipt of it? In most of these cases with the client rulers, their power was – they had more power than a governor but not as much power as a real king. The main difference between them and a real king is they didn't get to appoint their successor. Power wasn't automatically transferred to their next of kin, their son or a brother when they died, or even just a 2IC. They couldn't appoint who came next. Right. That was going to be up to Rome to decide who came next. Well, we have to vet the next guy because
extreme vetting.
Maybe you're a good guy, but maybe your son's a dickhead. We don't know. The only example, in fact, that we know of where a ruler was allowed to appoint his heir was Herod the Great.
Yeah. Must have stroked that royal staff. He gets to do what no one else does. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, we told that story about him where he went and sort of appeared before Augustus or Octavian after Antony was dead. Remember that story? And he went dressed as everyone else was going dressed, you know, sort of downscale. He goes dressed in all his finery and says, yeah, look, I supported Mark Antony. Yeah. And if you want me to, you know, if you don't kill me, I'll support you as well. But that's the kind of guy I am. I support my friends to the hilt. If you don't like it, kill me. But here I am.
Yeah, I make bad decisions, but I'm loyal.
And he actually put his wife and mother-in-law in a prison when he went to do that because he didn't trust them.
Pretty good idea.
He's like, if I die, they die. I don't want to running off with D'Angelo. It's bad enough as it is. He's walking around swinging that big black dick in my face every day. All right, well, we've run out of time. Let's leave it there. One more review, this time from the United Kingdom, from 20 Finn.
Hmm.
20 Finn writes, anyone who can claim the podcast isn't funny really needs to review the episode, which begins the time of Caesar in Gaul, during which one of the two presenters, when talking about the Gaulish tribe's compunction for hanging their slain enemies' heads on the front porches, their horses, and even embalming the particularly highly prized ones in cedar oil, uttered the immortal words, and that's how you get ahead in life. Mike, drop. Please keep making this podcast. It's awesomely wonderful, and I love it. Well, thank you, 20 thank you. Finn from the United Kingdom. Send us an email, ave@lifeofcaesar.com. If you only listened to that episode a month ago, it might be a while before you get to this one. But when you do get to this one,
yes, please
send us an email with your postal address, and we will, if we're still alive, we will send you a thank you gift.
If we haven't been taken out by the Secret Service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or my heart hasn't given in on me. All right.
No more bacon. Well, no more bacon, Cam.
More bacon. More bacon. I just take more heart tablets. Balance it up.
Actually, that would work.
Yeah. There you go. We'll be back with more Augustus. Don't forget to check out The Bullshit Filter.
Yes, please.
Don't forget to go and support my documentary, Inventing the Messiah, on Kickstarter if you can.
Yes.
It's going to be a hoot. Don't forget our Cold War show, our Life of Alexander show, Three Illusions show, World War II, Napoleon. Anything else we need to plug? That's it.
Just for all you Aussies out there, I will be coming down under soon. So all of those of you who have sent me nasty emails about all the animals that are going to try to kill me, I'm going to look you right in the eye and give you my response.
Yeah. June, July, Ray is, and family are going to be here. We're going to hit Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane. So get ready for that. Tickets will go on sale soon. It'll be $500 a ticket to get naked with Ray.
Not really. I'll do it for free. But it would be nice to have the money.
And $1,000 to get him to keep his clothes on.
Congratulations, boy.
I'm going to put my balls in your hands, and you know, I trust you to hold cut my balls. I'm not being turned on by this at all. That erection, that's not.
that's the wind.
It's not because it's turning me on. I'm always like that. Stiffy McGee, they call me. That's my nickname because I'm just Boner Jones. Now it's just
yours doesn't do that. Mine's always like this.
It rubs the lotion on its skin. It does this whenever it's told.